The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline, Breaking Through, How Nia Powell is Leveraging the Pandemic Challenges into Building Her Wellness Business, as part of the continuing series, 52 Shades of Success. And the continuing series begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, A Mission to Support Wellness, Nia Powell Leverages Virtual World by Going Global During COVID Pandemic. Story by Connie Gentry. About this project, the 52-week project showcases accomplishments, challenges, and opportunities of individuals and businesses run by people of color, women, immigrants, veterans, representatives from the LGBTQ plus community, and a few other groups forwarding the mission of diversity, equity, and inclusion in the greater Raleigh-Durham metro area. The project also will delve into important trends and issues relating to DEI. Silver linings are hard to come by in a pandemic-tarnished world, but an elevated appreciation of health and wellness has emerged. Business leaders are rethinking what it means to support their employees with benefits that reduce stress, restore work-life balance, and reinforce resilience. The global corporate wellness market will approach $42 billion this year after topping $37 billion in 2020, according to Research and Markets, a global insights and analytics firm. R&M estimates the wellness market will reach $72.8 billion by 2026. Nia Powell, founder and CEO of Utopia Spa and Global Wellness, USGW, expects to take just a sliver of that pie with an ambitious goal that Utopia will hit $100 million in revenue within the next 5 years. Powell, who launched USGW in 2018, began by bringing luxury spa services to clients at events and workspaces from consumers across the triangle to National Football League players. In-person services ceased abruptly when COVID hit, but the pivot Powell executed has propelled her into a virtual world that has expanded her services across 5 continents. We shifted our focus to scale as a tech-enabled wellness platform, Powell says. A strategic plan that has been fueled by $100,000 in non-dilutive capital awarded in October from the Google for Startups Black Founders Fund. We're using the Google for Startups funds to build out our technology solutions, she notes. That included a refresh of the website, which went live early this month. USGW provides on-demand, holistic, multicultural wellness classes and experiences, all held virtually, to combat the global stress epidemic that we're facing. Due to the increasing demands of work-life integration, people are overwhelmed, which has resulted in chronic levels of stress that impacts productivity, mental health, and overall well-being. Powell notes that 83% of U.S. workers suffer from work-related stress, a statistic that was reported by the American Institute of Stress in September 2019, months before COVID stressors were added to the mix. Stress takes a toll across the board, from individual productivity to bottom-line profits. A study led by the World Health Organization estimates depression and anxiety cost the global economy $1 trillion a year in lost productivity. And Johns Hopkins reports 65% of Americans say work is a top source of stress, per data from the American Psychological Association. Research shows U.S. businesses lose up to $300 billion annually as a result of workplace stress, and 60% of work absenteeism, or roughly 1 million employee absences every day, is attributed to stress. Companies are desperately looking for solutions. For all of those statistics, we're seeing an 88% of companies are investing in their workplace wellness programs, Powell says, adding that worker frustrations have led to a great resignation as people are reevaluating their lives and coping with how the pandemic has disrupted their sense of normalcy. People are deciding it's no longer worth it to be this estranged from family or this burned out. The mental health challenges and the time poverty that people are suffering from are causing burnout levels, at levels we've never seen before, she continues. All of these were challenges before COVID. Now they're accelerated, and companies are trying to figure out how to manage this in a hybrid work environment. One of the global companies searching for solutions was Powell's former employer, Red Hat, where she worked in global talent acquisition and served as vice chair of the employee resource group BUILD, Blacks United in Leadership and Diversity. We helped Red Hat solve for a number of things, not only the stress levels, the fear and anxiety of being in the midst of a global pandemic, but also how to focus on resilience and well-being, which is huge for companies. And we do this in a way that is inclusive of global teams, Powell says. Through live sessions and on-demand classes, USGW enabled Red Hat associates to gather virtually and maintain a sense of personal connection, even when travel and in-person meetings were not feasible. The Utopia Spa and Global Wellness corporate membership offered a brilliant opportunity for our global marketing team to address mental and physical wellness that was otherwise unavailable during the pandemic, says Natalie Duncan, project manager of Red Hat's Global Demand Center. Additionally, the fact that the classes were both live and on demand was a big plus, especially because we have a global team across multiple continents and time zones. USGW has also provided curated mindfulness sessions for Google, as well as services for WeWork and American Underground, and the company works with the collaborative partnership between NC Central University and Duke University to provide mindfulness-based stress relief programming for faculty, staff, and students at both schools. Undy N. Hoffler, director of the Research Compliance and Technology Transfer Division of Research and Sponsored Programs at NCCU, says they began working with USGW in 2020, and the engagement has been extended through 2022. We're building out programming in order to have mindfulness sessions continuously offered, and we're also looking at having it as a part of our public health instruction, she says. Within the Department of Public Health, we want to work with NIA to provide a certification in mindfulness for our students because they can utilize mindfulness in their practice after graduation. Hoffler adds that USCGW is also delivering mindfulness presentations to AME Zion Heal, the AME Zion Health Equity Advocates and Liaisons, or HEAL, is a partnership between AME Zion Churches in North Carolina and Duke Health that is working to reduce health disparities in underserved communities, striving to cultivate trust and dispel negative perceptions of clinical trials and research among people of color. My goal is to add 12 new global clients within the next 18 months and increase revenue to $20 million. Powell says USGW revenues increased 50% from 2020 to 2021, but she declined to say the dollar amount. I bootstrapped the start of the company, she says, adding that in addition to $100,000 in non-dilutive capital, the Google for Startups Award provides technical support and tools, including $120,000 in search ads and $100,000 in Google Cloud credit. The $100,000 in funding will be allocated 30% to technical development, 20% for business development, 15% to digital strategy, and another 15% to operations, and 10% each to recruitment and professional services. And we have one news article in the 52 Shades of Success section, Chinese classes for children and adults. Mandarin, which is the official language of China and spoken by more than 1 billion people, is considered the hardest language to learn. However, as both a heritage language and a second language, there is growing demand for classes in Mandarin Chinese. The demand is evident at Carey Chinese School, a nonprofit educational organization that was founded in 2003 and is run by volunteers. Chun Hu He, principal of the Carey Chinese School, or CCS, explains that the school offers classes in Chinese as a heritage language, CHL, for students who speak fluent Chinese, Mandarin. In that regard, the school has two curriculums to choose from, Zhang Wen and Mali Ping, and CHL teachers speak Chinese in the class the whole time. Chinese as a second language, or CSL, classes are for children as well as adults who want to learn Chinese. We have more CHL students than CSL students, since almost all Chinese parents would like their children to keep the heritage of the language. The advantage is that Chinese parents can help their children to master the language easily and provide sufficient help during the learning process, he says. One reason Mandarin is so difficult to learn, he explains, is because Chinese and English are not in the same language family, making it harder to master compared to other languages that are in the same family. The school's enrollment is about 700 students, including both language and activity classes, which is a little bit less than 2019, he says. For CSL students, the number dropped from 114 to 85, which had a higher ratio of declining enrollment than that for the CHL students. And CSL parents expressed the preference for in-person classes, especially for the younger kids, he said. In 2020, classes were held virtually. This year, CCS offers in-person as well as virtual classes. In addition to language programs, CCS integrates Chinese traditions, cultural enrichment, and sports into its curriculum. The school meets on Saturdays at Panther Creek High School. For information, visit carrycs.org. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Wake County home prices pass threshold. It's no surprise that the price of houses in Wake County is rising, and now the median price is a record-breaking $405,000. The Wake County Register of Deeds noted a surge in high-dollar transactions in November, despite a modest dip in core sub-million-dollar sales. According to the report, the county saw $791 million in sales in the very high-dollar category, including all sales above $30 million. This included a surge in high-end residential sales, as well as the Triangle Town Center, which was sold amid ongoing financial distress. Sales valued at $1 million or less saw $1.12 billion in total dollar volume last month, a $67 million dip from October's total of $1.18 billion. The show must go on until it doesn't. Patrons at the Durham Performing Arts Center were stunned December 11 when the 2 p.m. showing of Ain't Too Proud was canceled, with a packed house in the seats. The musical tells the story of the Temptations and has been a smash hit on Broadway, but at 2 p.m. the lights were still on in DPAC. About half an hour after the show was supposed to start, the theater gave an announcement that the performance would not happen. In an email to patrons, DPAC said the cancellation was, quote, due to technical malfunction. DPAC would like to extend a heartfelt apology, as we know unplanned circumstances like this are both an inconvenience and a disappointment. We, with live entertainment, occasionally things do not go as planned, DPAC said. We are truly sorry at this performance, as this performance cannot be rescheduled. Ticket holders received full refunds, meaning a revenue hit. DPAC seats about 2,700 people. No other performances appear to have been impacted, and a DPAC spokeswoman did not respond to multiple requests for comment. $8.8 million food facility on way to Eastern North Carolina. A group of seven counties will benefit from the new Eastern North Carolina Food Commercialization Center, or ENCFCC, which will help grow the area's food industry. The ENCFCC is a proposed 24,000 square foot facility that is one step closer to becoming a reality after securing $4 million from the North Carolina General Assembly. The total cost of the project is pegged at $8.8 million and will be located in the Pitt County town of Aiden. The center will provide food processing services for local farmers, food manufacturers, and entrepreneurs in the counties of Pitt, Lenoir, Greene, Wilson, Edgecombe, Martin, and Beaufort. This center will create jobs and economic progress by fostering the growth of food processing and manufacturing to include entrepreneurial endeavors, Aiden Mayor Stephen Tripp says. Local leaders kicked off development of the site December 13. Program supports new entrepreneurs. Applications are open for a federally funded program at the First Flight Venture Center in Research Triangle Park. Paid for through a grant from the U.S. Small Business Administration, the firm is planning for its 2022 Fast Boot Camp. The plan is to select 35 companies, and applications are being accepted through February 1. Hotel names are out of control. Biz had to laugh recently when an affiliate of Virginia's Southerly Hotels announced it had sold the DoubleTree by Hilton Raleigh Brownstone University Hotel for $42 million. Wait, what the heck is the DoubleTree by Hilton Raleigh Brownstone University? Oh, you mean the Brownstone Hotel that dates to 1966, right next to the YMCA. Yep, that's the one, but it turns out the Triangle has other properties with search engine friendly but otherwise confusing names. There's the DoubleTree by Hilton Raleigh Midtown, the Hampton Inn Raleigh Capitol Boulevard North, and the Hilton Raleigh North Hills, which is on Wake Forest Road. Kind of makes you appreciate the simplicity of the Velvet Cloak and even Isaac Hunter's Tavern. And finally, we have a big number, 51. That's the number of years that have passed since a Raleigh school won a state football title in the North Carolina High School Athletic Association. Broughton won it in 1970, and Cardinal Gibbons won the 4A title December 11. And now we turn to the On Finance and Tech page written by Lauren Onosorge. Durham's North Carolina Mutual close to end of run. Longtime Durham institution faces potential liquidation. Time could be running out for North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company in Durham, as a court hearing scheduled for this month could lead to its complete liquidation. 3 years ago, the firm, believed to be the oldest historically black insurer in the nation, was placed into rehabilitation under the purview of the North Carolina Insurance Commission, which tried to right the ship. But with the liquidation petition set to be heard this month, it appears those efforts have failed. NC Mutual was founded by a barber and a doctor in 1898 and grew alongside M&F Bank to be a financial center of what was known as Black Wall Street in Durham. The end of NC Mutual would be the end of a piece of local history, but it could also kick in policy protections that, while salvaging payouts for some members, might not make everyone whole. Peter Galanis, president of the National Organization of Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Associations, compares rehabilitation to a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, where the state works to save the company. If it is determined that the problems of the company can't be solved through rehabilitation, then the case may move to liquidation stage, he says. Liquidation, like a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, is seen as a last resort. Liquidation is a step that takes place basically after all other steps have been tried, Galanis says. In September, NC Insurance Commissioner Mike Causey filed for an order of liquidation and other relief against NC Mutual. It's scheduled to be heard the week of December 20. While there are guarantee associations that protect policyholders, the protections only go so far in the event of a liquidation. In North Carolina, even if an insurance firm liquidates, policyholders are protected to the tune of $300,000, but that's cumulative. If policyholders have multiple plans with the same liquidated insurer and they add up to more than $300,000, it's not all protected. A liquidation order would trigger the statutory coverage responsibilities of the individual guarantee associations of where the policyholders reside, Galanis says. Court filings connected to NC Mutual's possible liquidation show the firm has exceeded its assets by nearly $78.4 million. Convicted financier petitions Supreme Court. Stephen Peters, the former Raleigh financier in federal prison after being convicted in 2019 of orchestrating a Ponzi scheme, is trying to get the U.S. Supreme Court to look at his case. Peters has filed a writ of certiorari, asking the country's highest court to look at the circumstances of his conviction, which has already been through an unsuccessful appeals process. It's a long shot, as the Supreme Court is under no obligation to hear these kinds of cases. But in a December 3 filing, Peter's attorney, William Turpining, argues that his client's rights were violated in the initial trial when about $330,000 in assets were restrained, leaving Peters unable to pay his defense counsel. The 800-pound primate in the room. A judge in the appeals case of entrepreneur Greg Lindbergh says what constitutes an official act is the 800-pound primate in the room. Lindbergh, founder of Eli Global, was convicted of trying to bribe North Carolina Insurance Commissioner Mike Causey. His attorney, Howard Rubin, argued on appeal this month that the jury had been given improper instructions on what an official act was, and he should get a new trial. U.S. Attorney Amy Ray told 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Roger Gregory, "It's minutia that shouldn't matter. Based on the evidence presented, can we say beyond a reasonable doubt that the jury would have found that Mr. Lindbergh offered money in exchange for an official act, Ray argued. Dude Solutions buys Michigan-based company. Dude Solutions of Cary has disclosed the buyout of Michigan-based Facility Health. Financial terms were not disclosed. Dude Solutions is a Clear Lake Capital Group-backed technology firm with a software platform that helps businesses manage assets, facilities, and operations. And finally, a big number, $350 million. That's the amount raised by San Francisco-based Sysdig, now at a total funding haul of $744 million. The firm has an R&D hub in Morrisville, but it also has sales, marketing, and customer service personnel working out of the office. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Caleb Harshberger. Old Town, close to reality after delays. First units open, 1,600 to go for long-awaited Raleigh development. Eric Rifkin knew he had to move fast. It was the fall of 2018, and 515 acres of developable land minutes from downtown Raleigh had just hit the market after a potential buyer backed out of a deal. Developers had been eyeing the land since 2003. Rifkin, a Raleigh-based project manager with the Halley Companies of Maryland, called his higher-ups and urged them not to wait. The discussion Mr. Halley and I had, we'll probably never see another opportunity to see 515 acres 20 minutes from downtown Raleigh, he says. Just 21 days later, the Halley Companies paid $10.5 million for the property without even getting development approvals from the city. Now the first units at Old Town are open with more than 1,600 more on the way. The Halley Companies have opened 72 of 360 apartments underway at the project, and construction is slated to start soon on the 740 townhomes and more than 600 senior living homes. The project is situated at the corner of South New Hope and Rock Quarry Roads. Site work is underway throughout the property, but only the apartments and some amenities have gone vertical. Rifkin says they're leasing the units as fast as they can deliver them. Last month, we opened the apartments for leasing and have seen tremendous demand for our product, he says. The apartments feature studio, 1, 2, and 3-bedroom units across 16 buildings that rise 3 stories. Rents are fairly low by Raleigh standards for new construction, ranging from $990 a month for smaller units to as high as $1,800 a month for larger ones. We've been hitting that missing middle workforce housing component for a decade, Rifkin says. The Lenore Corporation of Florida will develop all 740 townhome units. The Halley Companies plans to work with a separate builder on the senior living homes. Developers seek new zoning for 275 acres in southeast Raleigh. This month, the Doran Companies of Minnesota filed a rezoning request with the city to allow for residential and commercial development on 275 acres across a pair of parcels at 6700 Rock Quarry Road and 2533 Wall Store Road. If the rezoning is approved, the bulk of the property would be zoned for denser residential use than is currently allowed, up to 8 units per acre after conditions are considered. And a commercial mixed-use segment would allow up to 3 stories of development on a portion of the property. The property totals 275.8 acres. The applicants are looking to combine the two properties into one large site and bring the bulk of it under an R10 zoning district, up to 10 units per acre, with a portion of the property to be zoned for commercial mixed-use development up to 3 stories. Conditions would limit residential density to 8 units per acre and prohibit apartments in the part of the property zoned for just residential. In the portion requested to be zoned for commercial mixed-use, residential density would not be allowed to exceed 20 units per acre. Non-residential uses would be limited to no more than 300,000 square feet. Developer targets more than 300 homes. Earlier this year, Clayton-based Strong Rock Development Company filed plans for the Lake Myra Ellis subdivision, calling for 332 townhome and single-family detached lots in Wendell. The property is situated on 76 acres at 1001 Seely Farm Road, south of Wendell Falls, a large mixed-use destination that just leased plans for a new Starbucks in the community. Plans for the subdivision call for 131 townhomes and 201 single-family detached homes. Amenities listed in filings with the town include pocket parks, a pool, a clubhouse, a trail network, dog parks, and a playground, among others. Filings say 26.2 acres will be reserved for open space. And we have a big number, $55 million. That's how much an LLC addressed to Braddock and Logan Services paid for the 240-unit Patriots Point Apartments in Hillsboro, or $229,166 per unit on December 13. The seller is a collection of LLCs addressed to the Silver Point Group, LLC, in New Jersey, that bought the property for $25 million in 2018. And we have one final note on a transaction on this page. Dallas-based NXRT High House LLC paid $93.25 million for the 302-unit Hudson High House apartments in Cary, according to a Wake County deed dated December 8. The deal comes out to $308,774 per unit. The buyer is addressed to investment platform NexPoint. The property is situated on 24.7 acres at 100 Terrestone Place and is down the road from a group of retail properties at the intersection of High House Road and Davis Drive. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to On Greater Triangle Growth, written by Evan Hoopfer. Clayton Mill will become apartments. In booming Clayton, Old Mill to be transformed. A developer with an active presence in the Triangle is looking to bring more housing options to Johnston County. Construction on Spinning Mill Loft started last month with delivery expected by Q3 2023, says Thomas Taft Jr., principal at Greenville-based Taft Family Ventures. The apartment complex, located just southeast of downtown Clayton near Main Street, will include 255 units. This project has long been in the works, as Taft says the land was closed on in 2018 in the fast-growing town. The location was a big driver, Taft says. Clayton was a great idea 3 years ago. It's an even better idea now. Taft Development Group, the development arm of Taft Family Ventures, is working with its joint venture partner, New Bern-based UHF Development, on the project. A major part of this project is 25 units will be located inside the more than a century-old mill on the property. Those units feature 25 different floor plans, Taft says. Some of them will feature actual lofts, so the living space would be up above the kitchen with an open living room, which has 20-foot ceilings and exposed beams, he says. Amenities will also be located in the old mill and include a swimming pool, co-working spaces, gym, bicycle repair station, and a small historic section showing the different bits and pieces of the old mill. Two businesses plan expansion to Smithfield. Jennifer Wilson calls Johnston County home, but that's not the reason she's expanding two of her businesses into Smithfield. It's the county's growth. It would have been stupid not to move out that way, she says. Wilson has two businesses that are each expanding to Smithfield. The first is Top Notch Pet Spa, which has one other location in Raleigh. The other business is Nature's Relief, a store that sells items such as CBD and products made from hemp. And that's spelled Nature's Relief, R-E-L-E-A-F. This will be the fourth Triangle location for Nature's Relief. Others are in Raleigh, Mooresville, and Garner. An LLC registered under Wilson's name purchased 925 North Brightleaf Boulevard for $300,000, according to a deed filed November 16. Top Notch Pet Spa will take one half of the building, and Nature's Relief will take the other half, Wilson says. She says the plan is to open the Smithfield spot in April. Developer targets 165 home project. Smithfield held a public hearing this month for Harvest Run, a development that would include 165 home lots. The land sits along North Carolina Highway 210, near where it intersects West Market Street. The development would be located right next to Marin Woods, another housing development that was recently approved by Smithfield. The developer is listed as Natalie Communities, a Gaithersburg, Maryland real estate development company. Harvest Run would be built on 45.67 acres. The development team proposed a rezoning from R20 to an R8 conditional zone, which allows for higher density and was approved by Smithfield. And in a section called She Said It, we have a quote from Natalie Hawkins, Executive Director of Moore County Partners in Progress, on furniture maker Minhas announcing plans to double its current workforce of 66 in Robbins. In just 3 years, Minhas has breathed life back into not one but two vacant industrial buildings in northern Moore County, putting them to productive use again and making a substantial investment in Robbins, both in new job creation and capital investment. And finally, we have a big number, 96. That's how many lots home builder KB Home of Los Angeles is building in Harnett County after it purchased 161 acres for $1.7 million earlier this month. And now we turn to the On Healthcare and Higher Ed page, written by Zach Ezone. Fighting COVID with the power of plants. RTP facility could produce plant-based COVID vaccine. A manufacturing facility in Research Triangle Park may soon begin producing the world's first approved plant-based COVID-19 vaccine. The Canadian biotech firm Medicago has announced results from a Phase 3 study for its vaccine. GlaxoSmithKline is also involved in the effort and produces a pandemic adjuvant, which enhances the immune response. That's spelled A-D-J-U-V-A-N-T. According to Medicago, this vaccine candidate had a 71% efficacy rate against all COVID variants in the 24,000-person trial. The company also says that no serious adverse effects were reported during the study. The company's medical officer, Brian Ward, says Medicago's final regulatory submission to Health Canada, the country's equivalent to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, will take place imminently. The company is also seeking approval from regulators in the U.S. and other countries. If that approval comes through, Medicago would ramp up manufacturing at its facility in RTP to fulfill a contract it already has in place with the Canadian government. The country has pre-purchased 20 million doses with an option to purchase an additional 56 million doses. To prepare for this, the company of about 800 employees, including third-party contractors, hired more than 150 workers over the last year. A large portion of these employees were brought on to scale up production at the RTP facility for clinical trials. Ward says the company will likely bring on an additional 150 employees over the next 12 months. These hiring efforts will ramp up even more as Medicago prepares to open a production facility in Quebec City in 2024 that's larger than its plant in RTP. After that facility becomes fully operational, the company may change the focus of its Triangle facility. How that facility is used and grows will really depend on the needs at the time, Ward says. The company built out its facility in the Triangle through a 2010 partnership with the U.S. Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. The facility features greenhouse space and an automated extraction and purification system. And we should point out Medicago is spelled M-E-D-I-C-A-G-O. Duke Health's new $265 million facility, now fully occupied. Duke University Hospital's new 350-bed tower is now fully occupied. Duke Health said December 13 it moved its children's hospital to the first four floors of the new tower over the previous weekend. Duke Central Tower is a $265 million facility that the healthcare system began construction on in 2017. Prior to moving its pediatrics units, the healthcare system in June moved adult patients to the other floors of the 11-floor building. This includes units for oncology, neurosciences, orthopedics, and transplant in the 490,000-square-foot facility. Mary Martin, chief operating officer of Duke University Hospital, said the patient rooms in the new tower are about twice the size of those in the 40-year-old main patient tower called Duke North. These larger rooms are more suitable for present-day medical technology and provide space for the families of long-term patients. Durham CRO solidifies South Africa presence. A Durham-based contract research organization is gaining access to the clinical trial market in South Africa through a recently announced acquisition. FHI Clinical has entered a purchase agreement to acquire South Africa-based Triclinium Clinical Development. The transaction is expected to close by the end of January. The terms of the deal have not been disclosed. Through this acquisition, FHI Clinical can offer its customers access to the largest market for clinical research in sub-Saharan Africa. CEO Ted Fitzgerald says, much of this involves studies of therapeutics for infectious disease. And in a section called He Said It, the quote is from Steve Butts, CEO of Arrivo BioVentures, on the Valley of Death in drug development. This is the gap in which Arrivo operates between the early stage research and the point at which large pharmaceutical companies pick up and carry a drug candidate to the market. There's a lot of innovation out there not getting translated to the clinic. And finally, a big number, $88 million. That's how much Aery Pharmaceuticals earned up front in a development and commercial agreement the company signed with Santen, a global ophthalmology company headquartered in Japan. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, Towns, Cities Must Speed Up Approvals, Denials. A few days ago, the Wake County Register of Deeds issued a note stating that for the first time in Raleigh's history, the median home price in the city has gone past $400,000. Just 10 years ago, that number was slightly above $200,000. In January of this year, it was $328,000. We have talked about the need for additional housing, addressing affordability, and making room for all these companies and their employees who want to come to the Triangle to work, live, and play. But it looks like we have a logjam when it comes to towns and cities keeping up the pace of approvals and denials of these site plans, building permits, and rezoning requests. Increasingly, just like they do every time, developers and investors are saying Triangle towns and cities are taking months before approving development projects, specifically to add to our housing inventory. It's costing the whole system thousands of additional dollars that can be prevented through streamlining. Town and city officials, in turn, say they are overwhelmed by the volume and shortage of labor in many cases. What all parties involved in the process need to realize is that both points are valid, but the current situation is beginning to kill the Triangle's vibe. Sure, existing homeowners are ecstatic as they watch the value of their homes skyrocket without them doing anything. What surprises me is they are often the same people who can be characterized as the NIMBY, not in my backyard crowd. They want to use hyperbole and vehemently say town officials, elected leaders, and planning directors are all on the take, or at least too inept to deal with development issues. Maybe some of them are, but that's not the point. The primary point is towns and cities must review every application closely, and officials must be smart and learned enough to approve or deny requests promptly. For that to happen, we need uniform codes. Before writing this column, I talked to a few people around the Triangle, and most say there is a power play in existence in virtually every level, so a chance of a uniform code across all municipalities is a pipe dream. Okay, then let's hold everyone that gets paid by the taxpayers accountable. Developers and investors who are waiting on the fate of their applications should pool their resources and create a master list of all projects and the approval status of each and every one of them on a monthly basis, right from when the application was filed, the project details, and the current status. Initially, we should look at all projects in Wake, Durham, Orange, Johnston, Chatham, and Franklin counties. Our housing crisis is getting worse. Numbers show it. We are having a record number of companies calling the Triangle home, and the newcomers, workers, will soon face a sticker shock when they land here. And please don't bring the argument of San Francisco and New York residents moving and finding housing cheaper here. That's not an argument. Big cities have different amenities, different challenges, and different demographic mixes. We have our own values, and we must adapt to the change. The sooner we get these new homes, site plans, single-family, townhomes, apartments, off the ground, the sooner we will be better as a community. And now we turn to some general news articles in the Triangle Business Journal. Silverback Fund eyes golden moment. Chapel Hill hedge fund manager Elliot Boson has big plans. Written by Lauren Onasorge. 2022 could be a key year for a stealthy hedge fund in Chapel Hill, as well as its under-the-radar founder. Silverback Asset Management and its CEO, Elliot Boson, have long been quiet, opportunistic players in the Triangle, but like other similarly situated companies, they're trying to take advantage of pandemic trends, including dislocation. And as the ebbs and flows of COVID-19 continue to disrupt and surprise Wall Street, high stakes are at play in Boson's ability to read the trend lines, and not just for private investors. That's because as of June 30, the state had a Silverback position valued at $83.2 million, according to the North Carolina Department of State Treasurer. A year ago, it was valued at $53.1 million. Boson, through a company spokesperson, declines to comment. A spokesperson also declines to comment on the firm's strategy. Boson, industry watchers note, has a reputation of being able to read the market, and he has made big moves through the pandemic that appear to back up the observation and create curiosity for what he could do next. Moves in 2021. Earlier this year, Silverback kicked off the Silverback Convertible Fund. So far, a securities filing dated October 12 shows $5 million raised from one investor. A report in Bloomberg had teased the fund in June, sourcing people with knowledge of the plan, as reporting that the Silverback Convertible Fund would soon open with a capital target of $500 million to $1 billion. The plan, according to Bloomberg, was to start with money from existing investors in Silverback's soon-to-be-halted dislocated credit fund, and then add in new investors. It's in line with Boson's opportunistic strategy, industry watchers have told the Triangle Business Journal in recent weeks. Silverback is what's called a convertible arbitrage fund, which invests in both convertible securities and common stock. The firm, based in Chapel Hill, is a hedge fund with 9 clients and discretionary assets under management of nearly $1.2 billion. Silverback, according to a recent disclosure filed with the SEC, manages $681.3 million in traded securities, with positions in firms such as Lyft, Beyond Meat, RumbleOn, and Durham-based Wolfspeed, formerly known as Cree. Silverback is one of a few long-running hedge funds, unregulated funds made up of private investor dollars that use a range of trading strategies to snag returns in Chapel Hill. Mark Yusko, industry watcher and founder of Morgan Creek Capital in Chapel Hill, described Boson as one of the top convertible guys on Wall Street before making a home in North Carolina. He's forgotten more about convertible bonds than most will ever know, Yusko says. Long history in Triangle. Boson retired to Chapel Hill only to decide he didn't want to actually retire. The publicity-shy executive began setting up hedge fund shops in the mid-1990s, essentially introducing sophisticated private investing to the region. He started Silverback in 2002, and along the way he built up a reputation as a smart investor. Over the years, Boson's fortunes rose and fell with the ups and downs of convertible arbitrage, and he contracted the firm when he had to. He contracted, made smaller the firm when he had to. The state of North Carolina took its own bet on Silverback in 2013, investing $125 million into Boson's strategy under then State Treasurer Janet Cowell. Those who know Boson describe him as opportunistic, particularly during the dislocations. And Yusko says the latest fund is an example of exactly that aptitude. Durham Seafood Restaurant to reopen after years of shutdowns, written by Laura Bramette. A Durham restaurant that has been open a total of 39 days since April 2019 is ready to resume operations next year. Executive chef and owner Matt Kelly plans to reopen St. James Seafood in late January after almost 3 years of a closed dining room. The restaurant, located at 806 West Main Street in Durham's Brightleaf District, serves North Carolina seafood and has a raw bar featuring the Triangle's largest selection of oysters. When a natural gas explosion hit Duke Street on April 10, 2019, killing 2 and injuring 25, St. James was one of several restaurants in the area forced to close. Firefighters stopped the fire from reaching the restaurant, and no structural damage was reported. The seafood spot originally opened in November of 2017. After the explosion, the restaurant was closed for 9 months before reopening on January 23, 2020. But the dining room was only open for 39 days before its next shutdown came when restaurants across the state were ordered to halt indoor dining. Kelly estimates the amount he lost across both shutdowns is in the seven figures. Before the closing, St. James was an almost $3 million restaurant, he says. The 3,800-square-foot space includes seating for 105. With the reopening, the menu offerings will be largely the same. The restaurant buys from North Carolina fisheries and serves domestically sourced seafood. Kelly says no investments were made into the restaurant during the shutdown. St. James Seafood was approved for forgivable loans totaling more than $600,000 through the federal Paycheck Protection Program. Economists say inflation is sticking around. Lower-income households will get hit harder as the price of goods rises. Article is written by Caroline Hudson of the Charlotte Business Journal. Economists based in Charlotte are expecting inflation to cause problems in the new year. Data released recently showed a 6.8% rate, the highest it's been in decades, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Mark Vintner, senior economist at Wells Fargo Securities, has a word for it: pernicious. It's not just that it's persistent, it's going to cause more trouble for the economy than I think people realize, he said. A key driver of this inflation round is the cash poured into the markets as part of economic support during COVID-19. There were stimulus checks, enhanced unemployment benefits, and child care credits, which also encouraged more domestic spending, said John Connaughton, a professor and economist at UNC Charlotte. Consumers have been looking to spend money on more goods than are being produced. He named several goods showing substantial inflation. Overall, energy prices are up 30% year over year, Connaughton said, with gasoline up nearly 50%. Car and truck rentals are up by 39% year over year. Used vehicle prices have increased by more than 25%, he said. Inflation will be bad if leaders don't get a handle on it now, Connaughton told listeners at a recent UNCC economic forecast. The economy has moved toward cost-push inflation, when prices increase because of higher costs for wages and materials. It is weathering a decline in labor participation rates, supply chain issues, and ongoing COVID effects. Connaughton recalled the double-digit inflation rates of the 1970s. I'm not suggesting in any way, shape, or form that we're going to experience that going forward, but it's something that we should be concerned about, he said. Vintner noted how inflation disproportionately affects low- to moderate-income households. He believes inflation will stick around for a while, despite a likely peak in the first half of 2022. Vintner expects nationwide inflation rates averaging 3% to 5% through the middle of the decade. For context, the Federal Reserve has been targeting a 2% inflation rate. Transformed outlet mall in Morrisville nets $181 million. This article is written by Caleb Harshberger. A new lab and life science campus built out of a former outlet mall in Morrisville has been sold to a New York real estate firm in a deal topping $180 million. An affiliate of Related Fund Management paid $181.8 million for the Stitch, according to a Wake County deed filed December 14. The fully leased property features 245,159 square feet of Class A office and life science space built out of the former Prime Outlets Mall. The Stitch is situated at 1001 Airport Boulevard, just south of Interstate 40. Built in 1981, the property operated as an outlet mall for decades before it began losing tenants, with just one left by 2019. The seller, Equator Capital Management of New York, bought the property in a $15.5 million sale in 2019 and announced plans to transform the aging mall. The company brought on Gensler to design the project and this year signed on Invitae, a genetic testing company based in San Francisco, to lease the whole property. In April, Invitae announced it would launch a testing and laboratory facility in Morrisville with plans to create 374 jobs. Sarah Owen, David Maline, and David Finger of Cushman & Wakefield represented Equator Capital Management in the sale of the property. The Stitch embodies a combination of the most sought-after components that investors are seeking in our market today: a highly desirable location, unique and well-executed creative class redevelopment, and a strong life science tenant, Owen says. Cushman & Wakefield's equity, debt, and structure finance team of Brian Linehan, Mike Ryan, Richard Henry, and J.P. Cordero secured acquisition financing on behalf of the buyer. Related Fund Management is part of the Related Companies, a privately held firm that deals in real estate investment and development across multiple sectors from retail to residential and office in major U.S. markets. The company says its portfolio is valued at more than $20 billion. The Stitch is one of a growing number of properties redeveloped into life science space as investor demand in that sector continues to explode. In Garner, a defunct Kmart Supercenter is slated to be reshaped into life science space following a recent sale. And in Raleigh, Chapel Hill-based developer East West Partners has unveiled plans for the Midtown BioCenter at the former Kroger location at 350 East Six Forks Road. Raleigh Builder plots homes in Chatham. An active Raleigh builder is looking to start development next year on a project south of Chapel Hill. Roebuck Homes plans a 31-home lot community called Chapel Oaks, located in Chatham County. The land sits near US 15501, about 6 miles south of downtown Chapel Hill. Joe Sabina of TBM Partners, part of the Roebuck family of companies, says it's not yet known what the price range will be for the homes, but they will range in size between 3,500 and 4,000 square feet. He says the homes will be similar to what Roebuck Homes is currently building in Bonterra. Bonterra is another Roebuck Homes community about 2 miles from Chapel Oaks on Man's Chapel Road. On its website, Roebuck Homes currently has a 3,474 square foot home within Bonterra listed for $903,250, and another 3,873 square foot home listed for $968,250. Sabina says development work on Chapel Oaks is expected to begin in mid-2022, with home construction starting at the end of 2022 or beginning of 2023. Roebuck Homes closed on $55.7 million worth of home contracts in 2020, according to a TBJ research, ranking it the 22nd largest home builder locally. The average price of a home built locally by Roebuck Homes last year was $476,000, according to TBJ Research. And that article was written by Evan Hoopfer. Leader who helped shape two triad towns to retire. An NC State University graduate who spearheaded efforts to revitalize downtowns in two of the largest triad cities has announced his retirement. Ray Gibbs, the executive director president of Forward High Point Incorporated since 2016, has informed the organization's board of directors that he will retire at the end of January. Gibbs was also the president of Downtown Greensboro Incorporated from 1999 to 2007. Gibbs played a key role in the development of First National Bank in Greensboro and Truist Point in High Point and the residential and retail projects developed around them. The 61-year-old Gibbs, who earned a degree in environmental design and landscape architecture at NC State, also worked as a senior landscape architect and urban planner at WSP Sells in the Triangle and Charlotte Market, president of the Phoenix Community Development Corporation in Martinsville, Virginia, and operated a landscape architecture firm in Martinsville. Gibbs, who has had some exploratory heart surgery over the past year, says he wants to reduce his daily stress. He says he expects to make himself available for work part-time as a consultant, but has nothing specific set. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we'll turn back to the Viewpoint page to read the guest column written by Ambassador Louise Blaze, who is Acting Counsel General of Canada to the U.S. Southeast, covering Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Tennessee. The headline on her Viewpoint column, Tax Provision Bad for Canada, North Carolina Trade. As Acting Counsel General of Canada to North Carolina, I've seen firsthand the prosperity that comes from trade between the United States and Canada. Look no further than the auto industry. Through years of specialization and integration, our two countries now lead the world in producing cars, trucks, and other vehicles. In 2019 alone, Canada bought over $686 million worth of auto parts from workers in the Tar Heel State. Overall, the $100 billion in automotive trade that the U.S. and Canada do each year helps to sustain 1.1 million good-paying jobs, many of which are unionized. Unfortunately, as the industry transitions to electric vehicles, this future is at risk of stalling if the new tax credit for electric vehicles, or EVs, proposed in the Build Back Better bill passes the Senate. There are certain parts of this tax credit that are jeopardizing the U.S.-Canada automotive industry and threatening to kill jobs in North Carolina. Here's how. Right now, Americans and Canadians make cars together seamlessly. Companies on both sides of the border routinely trade parts back and forth 5 or 6 times before a final vehicle rolls off the assembly line. And because that integration is so well balanced, Canadian-made cars already have, on average, about 50% U.S. content. Canadian cars are U.S. cars. That's true right here in North Carolina. Unfortunately, there are elements in the tax credit that will throw a wrench in the economics of our shared industry. Since Canadian assembled vehicles won't be eligible under the tax credit, the jobs in the U.S. that are supported by orders from Canada will be at risk. Those orders will simply dry up as the integrated supply chains are interrupted and uncertainty around cross-border trade takes hold. By changing the economics that have kept our automotive industry globally competitive for decades, jobs will be at risk at a time when we can't afford to lose our global competitive edge on EVs. We must build resilience against global challenges into our shared supply chains. Our joint work on critical minerals is an example of continuing that cooperation and is key to meeting our mutual goals, supporting the electrification of the transportation sector, meeting increasing demand for zero-emission vehicles, creating jobs, and ensuring security of the supply chain from mines to mobility. If we do not approach the next generation of automotive production together, it will only benefit offshore competition. If Canada is shut out of the U.S. EV market, there will be pressure from Canadians to respond. If Canada is forced to retaliate, North Carolina will be hurt economically in the long run. The two-way trade relationship in goods between North Carolina and Canada was worth U.S. $9.1 billion in 2020. There are over 200 Canadian-owned businesses in North Carolina, employing about 20,000 North Carolinians and contributing significantly to North Carolina's economy. We shouldn't be risking jobs with bad legislation and trade wars. But the good news is that there's still time to find a solution. Members of Congress, particularly in the Senate, are debating the details of this EV tax credit right now. Let's encourage them to find a solution that preserves the integrated Canada-U.S. automotive market so we can shift into high gear and together win the race on EVs. And we'll finish with the Business Pulse survey. What will be the biggest challenge for businesses in 2020? 160 respondents, 37.5% say labor shortage, 23.1% say ongoing supply chain issues, 18.8% say inflation, 13.1% say employee retention, and 7.5% say COVID-19. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.